Hello, it's Thursday, May the 13th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up on Monday, you can hug to your heart's content, but I'm talking to a journalist and author who can't stand hugging. I suspect she's not alone. We'll be talking to our diplomatic editor about what's going wrong and what's going on in Israel as the bombs and missiles go between Palestine and Tel Aviv. The Indian COVID variant, the SAGE Committee of Scientists are looking hard at it. Could it potentially derail coming out of lockdown on June the 21st? But first, the coronavirus inquiry. It begins next April. I'm talking to someone whose father died from COVID nearly a year ago, and she says it's far too long to wait. The Prime Minister has announced the long-awaited independent public inquiry into the coronavirus pandemic, but it's not going to start until the spring of 2022. Bereaved families are arguing a year is too long to wait for the probe to start. More than 127,000 people have died since the pandemic began last year, and part of that inquiry will focus on whether the death toll was adversely affected by the timing of going into not just the first lockdown, but also the second lockdown. I'm joined now by Hannah Brady. She's from the COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice campaign, who lost her father, Sean, last year. He was a factory worker to COVID. Hannah, condolences about your father. Just briefly tell us about him before you tell us what you want the Prime Minister to do about this campaign.
Thank you. So my dad was Sean Brady, and he was only 55 when he died of COVID on the 16th of May 2020. He was fit and healthy, and he had no underlying health conditions, but he was a key worker, and we think he caught it on his way to work before the March 2020 lockdown. He ended up spending about 42 nights in ICU on a ventilator.
He was really uncomfortable as well, and presumably unable to see you and his family.
Yeah, we were not allowed into the hospital until the night that we had to attend ICU to switch his ventilator off. So he'd been in a coma for 42 nights, so he had no idea what was going on.
No.
We couldn't speak to him.
Heartbreaking for you. He, like lots of key workers, he was a factory worker, Hannah, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. He worked at the Kit Green Heinz factory, and he'd worked there for 34 years.
Yeah. So he would be using a train, bus or taxi to get to work each day. So he might have been exposed to the pandemic there. You're not sure, presumably, where he caught it from?
No, we don't know for sure where he caught it, but we believe it was on his way to work.
Yeah. So you've heard the Prime Minister. He says that inquiry will be underway next spring. These are complicated. They take a long time to set up, but they don't take a year to set up. What are you arguing for, Hannah, that it should begin this year?
So we've been arguing since May 2020 that an in-public inquiry needed to start, and we're arguing for almost a two-phase inquiry. So we're aware that a huge public inquiry is going to take years and it can't be set up overnight. But we've seen precedents where public safety is at risk for disasters such as Grenfell and Hiddlesborough, that you can set up almost a rapid review that can report and produce interim reports within about 12 weeks. I think we've definitely got time for that. We should have done it in summer 2020 before the second wave hit. And we should definitely do it now in summer 2021 before a potential third wave in the winter hits. There are questions that needed to be answered in summer 2020 that are still causing issues for COVID bereavement. So things like hospital acquired COVID, care home acquired COVID, which both had much higher levels in the second wave than the first. Mm. We know from speaking to bereaved families in our group that those sorts of things are still happening. You know, people are still going into hospital now with broken legs, broken hips. Things that aren't death sentences, catching COVID in there and passing away.
Also, I wonder, Hannah, the advice on masks, covering this, the masks on this podcast from the beginning, the advice changed in the middle of the summer when the World Health Organization changed. There'll always be a concern, I suppose, for people who lost loved ones before that rule was brought in, that perhaps dad or mum or grandma might have been safer if they'd been wearing a mask.
Definitely, especially for my dad, using different forms of public transport in March 2020 to get to and from work. We know that in London, the highest death toll per occupation were transport for London workers, people like bus drivers, train drivers. Absolutely, the masks should have been brought in a hell of a lot earlier. I, for one, will certainly be using them after the mandate in things like supermarkets have been lifted.
And also, I'm just looking here, Hannah, you don't need me to tell you this because this will be etched in your heart, but figures released in January revealed that factory workers were among the occupations with the highest coronavirus death rates, which is another suggestion that A, not enough was done to protect them, and perhaps potentially still not enough is being done to protect them.
Absolutely not. So I believe that factory workers were disproportionately affected by COVID because not only did they work in close contact with a lot of other people, they're largely low-income workers, which means that if they catch coronavirus and test positive, they can't afford 2 weeks off work. So some of them potentially aren't isolating and they are still going into work, and it's spreading. And we're seeing that in places like Blackburn and Bolton, which are now reporting the highest cases of the new Indian variant.
Mm. For you and your family, Hannah, how important is it for you that you get answers to what happened, not just to your dad, Sean, but to others? What would it mean to you as a family?
It's massively important. My dad lived his life for other people. He raised money for charity. He ran volunteer football clubs for children. To think that the campaign that we have been running would help save even one life, but, you know, hopefully thousands and hundreds of thousands more, by securing a public inquiry, not to start when Boris Johnson wants in spring 2020 in 12 months' time, but start this summer and save lives. It would mean the world. It would mean that I could look at my dad's grave and think that I protected people like him from what happened to him.
Hannah, thanks for joining us. That's Hannah Brady. She's from the COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice campaign, who lost her dad, Sean, to the virus last year. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So could Britain's long-awaited path out of the lockdown be derailed by surging cases of a new Indian variant? Coronavirus cases are now at their lowest level since August, but the government's Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, you know it as SAGE, is holding an emergency meeting to discuss the Indian variant, with one expert already warning it could impact the final step out of lockdown on June 21st. I'm joined now by Dr. Peter English. He's a retired consultant in communicable disease control, and he's former chairman of the BMA Public Health Medicine Committee. Dr. English, welcome back to the podcast. How worried should we be? Because we know now, even amateurs like me know that viruses mutate and variants mutate. But is this one particularly worrying?
It was described in an article I was reading earlier by another journalist as a variant of concern, but not a variant of mass panic.
Right.
We've seen this variant take over in India, and it does appear to be even more infectious than the Kent variant.
Yes.
So it may be more infectious. There's some evidence that in laboratory tests, it appears not to generate as many antibodies, and it may not be quite as effective at preventing infection, but it looks like it's pretty much as effective at preventing serious illness, hospitalization and death, which is probably the most important thing.
Yes.
But it's something we're going to have to keep a very close eye on, because we've only got very preliminary data, and we really do need to know whether it's going to have an effect on how effective vaccines are.
Does this say to you, Doctor, that perhaps the government were a bit slow, brackets again, in putting India on the red list of countries allowed to fly to and from the United Kingdom? With the red list, of course, people would have to then quarantine in a hotel at their own expense for 10 days, which would be a huge deterrent for people from those countries coming here.
I was very surprised at how long it took them to classify it as a variant of concern rather than just a variant under investigation, and to put India on the red, on the blacklist or quarantine list. I can't understand why it took them so long.
I mean, I'm puzzled because they get advice from lots of places, and there's a large Indian community in the United Kingdom, of course. And then when they said that India was going on the red list of countries, they gave 4 days' notice. And apparently the flights then in from India to the United Kingdom were rammed solid with people trying to get in from India so they could avoid the onerous quarantine rules.
Well, this is exactly what happened last year. Entirely predictable. I'm afraid I can't explain why they did things the way they did.
In your view, because we know we've got the public inquiry, which will start next year, a lot of talk will be about whether we went into lockdown quick enough, the problems over PPE, we know all of that. But do you think a big part of that inquiry will also be, should we have shut down our borders like Australia and New Zealand much quicker? Because in fact, we've never have shut them down and we only started banning flights and restricting flights a few months ago.
That's a very difficult question. They've done it remarkably successfully in Australia and New Zealand, case numbers and ability to open up society that we can only dream of here. Whether that would have been feasible as an island off the just off mainland Europe, I'm not certain. The Australia and New Zealand have a lot less coming and going of people, I'm told. We have so many people coming and going from the UK on business and on things where we can't stop them. We're not self-sufficient for food and in necessary resources. There's so much that comes across the channel that I it's too complicated a question for a mere public health doctor, I'm afraid.
Well, that's why there'll be people like you, I suspect, will be giving evidence inquiry. Just finally, Dr. English, we have got this date of June the 21st. Politically, the Prime Minister has a lot riding on that because he's said, come hell or high water, we are lifting the lockdown on June 21st. Do you worry a little that the political pressures could, in some way, get in the way of what should be a very straightforward public health decision? If the Indian variant does become a cause for mass panic, for instance, as that journalist referred to, that should come long before any political decision about why we have to come out of lockdown by June the 21st.
Well, of course, he said it was a variant of concern, not a variant of mass panic. But
yeah,
the key thing, I think, is the number of cases we're getting. And at the moment, even though we've seen some rise, we're not having a huge number of cases. I think we will have to continue to monitor the number of cases and the number of new cases, and perhaps particularly the number of cases who get seriously ill. And we know that the vaccines are more effective at preventing people getting seriously ill than they are at preventing infection altogether. And we might decide we can live with people getting minor illnesses, as long as they're not getting seriously ill, dying, overwhelming the NHS. So I think it's probably okay, but I'm very nervous about saying it's all or nothing and we can never go back. We might have to.
Very interesting. That's Dr. Peter English, who's former chairman of the BMA Public Health Medicine Committee. Thanks for joining us. Now, we'd like you to visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe. Then you can access all of our podcasts, our videos, our opinion pieces, and lots more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at Mail Plus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. The United Nations has warned it fears full-scale war in Israel after more deadly exchanges of fire between the Israeli military and Palestinian militants in Gaza. Palestinians have fired at least 1,000 rockets and dozens, including children, have died as Israel has carried out hundreds of airstrikes on Gaza, destroying tower blocks. What does it all mean? And who started it and when? I'm joined now by our very own Mark Nicol. He's defence and diplomacy editor at the Daily Mail. Mark, a lot of people are talking about this could lead to a war between the two sides. It's the worst violence between them since, 2014?
Yeah, correct, when there was the Israeli ground incursion.
Yeah, so what was the trigger for this?
There are a number of factors. I think you've got a perfect storm of some historic factors which are always there, but which spike at particular times. There is a court case in Israel which is significant. It is the eviction from East Jerusalem of a number of Palestinian families. That has incited hatred and anger on the Palestinian side, understandably. You also have the end of Ramadan, where there is always or often a spike in violence at that time. In the background, slightly bigger political factors, you have got Netanyahu, who is seen to have nothing to lose now politically in Israel. Is he perhaps inciting Israeli security forces into a more vigorous restraint. You saw the Israeli policeman entering the mosque. Mm. Again, that's inevitably going to incite a violent response from the Palestinians. You also have the cancellation recently of Palestinian elections by the presidential elections by Abbas, who was predicted to lose them.
Funny that.
And Hamas was predicted to do very well.
Yeah.
So this is Hamas flexing its muscles. Is it Hamas giving a message to the Iranians, say, look, we are capable of causing the Israelis a lot of trouble. Give us the support we need. It's very complicated. And then on internally with Israel, and this is perhaps the aspect of it that is more difficult to quell, and that is the danger of the civil war. Mm. Because I think if you have conflict and killings between Arab Israelis and Israelis, if you have mobs on whichever side pulling people out of cars and killing them or whatever, that could take a lot longer to quell than the bigger, more political conflict, which inevitably that the Russians are eventually going to rein in Hamas and the Americans are eventually going to talk to the Israelis and they will step back.
I was going to ask you about America because, of course, Donald Trump was a huge, big, noisy supporter of Israel.
Yes.
Biden, like all American presidents, is pumping money into Israel, giving them international aid. But he's been... It's his first big foreign policy test, and he seems to be quite tentative and cautious.
Yes, he was. He doesn't do the rhetoric. Mm. It was similar. He took a similar stance when Russia mounted its very large military exercises near the Ukrainian border last month. Whereas Trump would have been banging on the table and saying, "This is out of order. You take one more step, and I'm going to rain hell on you." That's not Biden's approach. But I don't think. And people can perhaps question his commitment to Israel. For example, at the United Nations yesterday, there was a meeting of the 15 permanent members of the Security Council. They would have put out a joint statement condemning the violence on both sides had it not for the United States being the only country on the Security Council which objected to that joint statement. So it is still digging its heels in support of Israel, but just Biden doesn't do it in that bellicose way.
Britain's a minor player in all of this, really, aren't they? I mean, Dominic Raab, the Foreign Secretary, keeps saying, I defend the right of Israel to protect its territory, but appealing for both sides to de-escalate.
Yeah. We shouldn't kid ourselves and it's any different, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. Mm. If you don't have much skin in the game, let's not try to pretend that any different.
And let's not get sucked into some other ghastly conflict.
No, we have nothing to gain.
Just finally, Mark, I mean, the TV images, I can see some in the background now. It's pretty terrible. Is your hunch that this time it could be triggered into a full-scale war, not least because of Netanyahu's a loose cannon?
Not full-scale war, because I think Israel can achieve its military objectives in a more clinical fashion at a distance.
Yeah.
It certainly doesn't want to be getting involved in a close-quarter battle going through Gaza, where the civilian death toll will go through the roof, but it will also lose soldiers, a lot of soldiers, because that type of fighting is bloody. They have precision missiles, they have drones, they have all the technical assets, they have fantastic intelligence on the whereabouts of Hamas military locations, but they do not want to be get involved in a messy ground conflict. No. So I think while we're hearing a lot today about a plan for war or plan for a ground invasion is going to go to the Israeli cabinet for discussion and approval, I would be unpleasantly surprised were that to transpire. Yeah.
Just finally, Israel, having had a fantastic rollout of its own vaccine program, was going to do very well with people flying into Israel for nice holidays in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Well, they can kiss goodbye to that, can't they?
Yes, I think Israel was quite understandably pleased with itself as to how the successful rollout of its vaccine played out internationally, in that it was detoxifying the Israeli brand, if you can put it like this. But yes, all the territory gained from that has now been lost.
And could get worse. That's Mark Nicol. He is, of course, our defence and diplomacy editor at the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us. So Deputy Business Editor Hugo Duncan's here with the latest news from the Square Mile. Hugo, people think, oh, who cares about falling stock markets? We should worry, shouldn't we? What about my pension?
Well, exactly, Andrew. The stock market, you know, does have a bearing on people's lives. It's their pensions, it's their savings, ISAs, various other things. They've been on a good run of late. Obviously, there was a horrific fall as the COVID pandemic hit just over a year ago, but they have been recovering. And actually, in recent days, at the end of last week, the FTSE 250, a big marker of the British economy, house builders and high street shops, and so on and so forth, hit record highs. The FTSE 100 was at its highest level since the falls of last year. So there had been a recovery, but the markets this week have been in very, very jittery mood, and shares are on the slide in quite a major way.
Is a lot of it to do with the inflation rate in the United States?
Well, that's exactly the point, Andrew. The global economy at the moment is being helped. Its recovery is being helped by ultra-low interest rates, emergency funding from central banks like the Bank of England, like the Federal Reserve, and governments around the world are spending billions and billions and billions to support the economy. The great fear is that this is going to push inflation higher, prices rising. We've already seen copper hitting record highs, iron ore hitting record highs. This is, of course, the raw materials that manufacturers and others use to make their products, which then of course sell to the rest of us. Rising prices is what central banks fear most, and they may well, as a result, be forced to raise interest rates, withdraw emergency support, and that could well slow the economic recovery and make people think again about where they are going to invest in stocks and shares.
And it's funny, isn't it, Hugo, because when we challenge Rishi Sunak at the Chancellor and we challenge other people in government about the eye-watering levels of debt, we're always fobbed off with, yeah, but interest rates are at an historic all-time low. But now that could be changing, and that's going to put the country into a lot more debt if interest rates go up, because the debt bill goes even higher.
That is exactly right. And it's almost not the size of the debt that we should worry about, it's the cost of servicing it. As you say, with interest rates where they are at the moment, 0.1% in the UK, they have never ever been lower. They can't really go any lower. If inflation comes back, there's only one way interest rates can go, and that is up, and that puts up the cost of your mortgage, but it also puts up the cost of servicing government debt, which means billions extra to pay for the debt rather than paying for schools, for nurses, for police, and for all the other things that people want the government to be spending their money on.
Just finally, Hugo, Joe Biden's spending spree is at an all-time record, isn't it, in the United States, and that will presumably stoke up inflation fears even more.
Absolutely, absolutely. There is no saying that this inflation will come back with a vengeance, but the fears are that it is starting to rear its head, and once the genie is out the bottle, it is very, very hard to put back.
That's right. That's Hugo Duncan. He's Deputy Business Editor at the Daily Mail. So it's finally been confirmed, in England at least, they can hug people from next Monday as the COVID alert level drops again. But not everybody is exactly over the moon at that news. I'm joined by the author and journalist Esther Walker, who says she hates hugs and won't be hugging any friends next week. Oh, Esther, that's a bit antisocial.
Well, that's exactly the attitude, Andrew, that us non-huggers have to deal with in our lives. And that's why lockdown with the no-hugging rule has been sort of a respite from that. Because when you're not crazy about hugging just anybody, friends, whatever, you can come across as a bit weird. And we're not weird. We just sort of don't really like it. I do want to point out that I love hugging my children,
right?
And I will submit to being hugged by my husband,
right? But that's
hugging
it.
Hugging people, well, sort of being really sort of up close, I just find it a very sort of sensory overload. I think that's the best way I can describe it. It's just too much.
Bumping elbows during the lockdown, that suited you more, did it?
I loved it. It was a get out of jail free card. You know, a wave, a kind of a bump of an elbow, for a couple of weeks, people were kind of shuffling their shoes together. That was all fine. And now there's going to be this orgy of everybody all hugging each other. And I'm either going to have to sort of submit to it or shy away from people. And I just go back to feeling like this weirdo.
So you've got strategies for avoiding embraces. Shout hello across the room. Does that work?
you go, hello, and you put both your hands up in a kind of stop sign, and you go, hello, Jessica, or whatever, and then that's the greeting.
Yeah.
And then I feel like they would feel it was weird. People generally don't go in for a hug after that.
Yeah. I like the emergency. You'll actually say, I don't do hugs.
I don't do hugs. If I'm not feeling emotionally in a place where I can bear to just kind of submit to it, I usually sort of just clench my elbows to my sides and hold my sort of fists under my chin. And I say, I don't do hugs like that. More often than not, I just go with it because I know how offensive it can come across if someone feels like they don't want to touch you or they don't want to hug you. So normally if someone's just going in for a big hug, I just sort of go for it. But most people who know me know I don't want to be hugged.
Yeah, so, yeah. You know, people are going to read this article, so they're going to want to hug you even more. You do know this.
Some people say, I know you don't like hugs, but I'm going to do it anyway. And bless them. I mean, I love them for it. I love them for their joie de vivre and how much they feel hugs are really important. And, you know, I want to reiterate that in the right circumstance, I do really enjoy hugs, but just not from people I don't know that well and not like when I'm not expecting it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Do you like hugs, Andy?
I don't.
I imagine you're a bit of a hugger.
I am a bit of a hugger, but I'm just curious about this, Esther. Mm. What would you do if Boris Johnson, that familiar sight, came bounding up towards you and he'd read one of your books or he'd read one of your articles and hugged you? Would you make an excuse to avoid getting into an embrace with our rather well-proportioned Prime Minister?
You know what, Andrew? I met Boris Johnson a long time ago when I was a gossip columnist, and he it's quite hard for me to put this in my mind because he sort of ran away from me quite quickly. Having met him, I don't think he's much of a hugger. But I will answer your question. In theory, if Boris Johnson wanted to hug me, I would do the emergency I don't do hugs thing.
Oh,
I do like Boris, but I don't want to be hugged
by him. I think probably quite a lot of women would take that view, actually, of our Prime Minister, don't you?
Also, I've got to say, Carrie strikes me as being a very determined woman not to be messed with, and I wouldn't want her opprobrium.
No, I think she's quite territorial.
Listen, any woman worth her salt generally is, but particularly when it comes to the Prime Minister and Boris Johnson as
okay.
well. But again, I wouldn't want him to take that the wrong way. It's not him, it's me.
Okay, and just finally, if you and I bump into each other at a party or an event, you're not going to hug me, are you?
Well, I wouldn't turn one down. Sorry, I flim-flammed around that.
Right, right.
You see how awkward it is?
Yeah, it is.
It is, Andrew.
I wouldn't be offended.
Yeah, it's awkward.
But I wouldn't be offended, honestly. But there we are.
Well,
it's a terrific piece you've written, as ever. The journalist and author, Esther Walker, on why she hates hugs. And I suspect a lot of you listening hate them too. So why don't you send in your messages about hugs? That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, you can download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.